From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
When it comes to teaching in the classroom, who decides what's fact and what's fiction? I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A block of religious conservatives on the Texas Board of Education is shaping the contents of that state's textbooks, and by extension, many of the books that end up in schools across the country. How much control should elected officials have over what's taught in class? Is this breaking down the barrier between church and state? And do public schools too often ignore the role of religion in U.S. history? Later on Reporter's Notebook, making amends to African American farmers. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. Back in 1925, the Scopes trial raised the question of what should and should not be taught in school, specifically evolution versus creationism. 85 years later, the debate is still going strong. In Texas, questions are being raised about if and how the political and religious beliefs of elected officials should influence classroom content from science to history. On Reporter's Notebook, righting a long-standing wrong for black farmers. First, this news update. President Obama today announced a $1.5 billion program to help struggling homeowners stay in their homes. The program targets five states, Nevada, California, Arizona, Florida, and Michigan. Joining us now to explain the details is David Abramowitz. He's a senior fellow for housing policy at the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So, in a nutshell, what exactly is the president proposing here? What kind of assistance is he offering?
It seems to be very flexible money, as you said, $1.5 billion, that will go to state housing agencies and let them do essentially three different things. And these are in states where prices have plunged at least 20%, and there's a high risk of people who are still making their payments not being able to keep up and end up in foreclosure. So there are three major things that the states can do with this money. Use it to help people who are unemployed, probably as some sort of a bridge to get them through so they can get back into employment. The second area is helping borrowers who are, what they say, underwater. They owe more on their mortgages than their house is worth. And the third is people who could refinance, but they have junior liens, home equity loans, and the like, and need some help in working that out.
Now, we already have one program in place that is aimed at helping homeowners avert foreclosure. Why is a second one needed?
Well, a couple of things. One is just context. Despite the HAMP program going in effect about a year ago, the number of people around the country who are in default or behind on a couple of mortgage payments all the way to foreclosure keeps rising. We now have one out of every seven families with a mortgage is somewhere behind and facing foreclosure. So the problem's expanding. Second is the modification program is going slower than everybody had hoped. They've done about 900,000 modifications, but only about 100,000 of them have actually become permanent. And what's happening over time is that there are new problems arising as unemployment stays high and prices go down. So I think they decided that in the states that are most under stress, that they needed some special extra help to prevent more foreclosures.
So it sounds like basically that this first program, the HAMP program that you were talking about, has perhaps... You know, you can't say it hasn't done the trick, but it hasn't maybe helped as many people as need help. What's the guarantee that this second program is going to fix the problem?
Well, there's actually no guarantee of any of these programs. I think the hope and the experience is that they're channeling this money to state agencies who do have a track record of working with borrowers directly on home mortgage loans. A lot of these state agencies make home mortgage loans, and some of them have successful programs that these efforts are modeled on. So, for example, I believe Pennsylvania historically has had a program where someone becomes unemployed, they get some help to bridge the gap while they're unemployed, and they end up not losing their house. People have to realize that even if I'm not in default or behind on my mortgage, if there's a foreclosure next door to me and a vacant house, that's bad for me, bad for my property values, puts me more at risk of foreclosure, puts my local government more under stress to have a blighted place there. So you're trying to get money out the door in targeted ways that will prevent more stress on the whole system.
The program is offering $1.5 billion in assistance. How large is that, considering the scale of the problem? Is it enough to make a significant difference?
Well, I think you really hit on a point, which is the scale of the problem really is beyond the amount of money on the table, either for this particular targeted or even, frankly, for the whole program. One of the things that's gone on programs to date under this administration and more so under the past one is that at the end of the day, it's all voluntary for the lenders, for the folks who have the mortgages, as to whether they really modify and make a deal or not. And quite honestly, I think without more sticks in the arsenal for the administration to hold over the heads of lenders who are not modifying loans fast enough, it's the carrot of some amount of money won't be enough.
David Abramowitz is Senior Fellow for Housing Policy at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
In a moment, the academics of textbooks gets political. More on that coming up on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Cherry Glazer, back with To the Point. School boards often toil outside the spotlight, but that has not been the case recently for the Texas State Board of Education. Almost half of the elected group, 7 members out of the total 15, are conservative Christians who, along with the rest of their colleagues, take an active role in determining the contents of textbooks used in schools across the state. Some critics say these 7 members are using their position to insert their political views and their religious beliefs into the curriculum and even rewrite history. Here to help shed some light on the situation is Cynthia Dunbar. She's a member of the Texas Board of Education and a visiting professor at Liberty University Law School. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Ms. Dunbar, let's start with the basics. My understanding is that your board reviews textbooks in one main subject each year. This year, I hear the topic is history. How are you going about deciding what goes into the textbooks and what doesn't?
Well, that is the whole question that ultimately boils down to making this a very political decision, because ultimately when you deal with elected school boards, you're going to have to make the determination as to what needs to go in. And we don't want to be writing a curriculum. That's one thing that we try to stay away from. And we're also prohibited from developing any kind of pedagogy or the methodology of instruction. So the more that we can just adopt what we call the essential knowledge and skills, from which the curriculum can be developed and the textbooks can be drafted, means that we have to look at what is most important to not overburden the teacher instruction time in the classroom. And so that's where the debate comes into play, because there's got to be a determination as to whose assessment as to what's the most important is going to win out. And we are a member, 15-member board, and so on any given vote, it's 8 votes that determine and being responsive to our constituents within our elected districts to make sure that we are actively representing their viewpoints.
So how detailed does your work get? Are you reviewing individual texts? Are you looking at overall, you know, are you looking at specific articles? I mean, how down into the nitty-gritty do you get?
Well, we get pretty nitty-gritty. I mean, we have to – now, when you say are we reviewing individual texts, at this point, the processes that we adopt the TEKS, or the TEKS, which is Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills, so it's a mnemonic. And then from that, later on, the process is that we adopt textbooks that align with those TEKS. So right now, we're simply trying to place in the TEKS the essential knowledge and skills that we think need to be addressed within the classroom. And what we're trying to do on the board that I have seen pretty much, I think the overall assumption is that we want to make sure that they are getting a solid foundation so that they're not going into their college years where they're having to have remedial history like they're having remedial language and math in some situations. And so we're trying to make sure that they get the foundational support. And I think that's where we have been a driving force is, okay, if we're dealing with American history, let's specifically look to some of the charter documents, some of the more pronounced things that we can all agree on to make sure that the students have a solid foundational understanding of our American history.
Do you get involved in the very specifics, like, okay, in fifth grade, you know, we're going to talk about the Pilgrims and the settlers and sort of their motivations and what their lives were like, and then in sixth grade we're going to talk about the Civil War, or are you taking more of an overview?
Well, we do a grade-by-grade analysis because we do a grade-by-grade adoption, and it's from that that the textbooks are drafted. And so when it's presented to us, we do have to go through from kindergarten to first grade to second grade. So it's not just a general overview, and we have to make sure that the TEKS are grade-specific, that they're grade-appropriate. And based on that, there's already a foundational assessment as to when students learn perhaps Texas history or U.S. history, and we don't seem to veer from that too much. But then within that framework, we develop what we think is the most basic fundamental issues that need to be covered.
Are you getting input from teachers or historians or, you know, depending on the issue, scientists, you know, people where this is the field they study?
Well, of course, we get input. Statutorily, we are required to get input from a myriad of different sources. We are supposed to be listening. Ultimately, the board is responsible for the adoption, but we listen to the input of teachers. We have an expert review panel. We listen to, we're supposed to listen to the input of the parents and even businessmen. I mean, it's an overall process, and the reason it is because we are an elected board. One of the questions that came forward was, well, how appropriate is that? Shouldn't we leave this to the experts? The problem with that assessment is, okay, who's experts and who do we define as the experts? And if we take it and move it away from an elected board that is accountable to the people and to the electorate and put it in the hands of just appointed, quote-unquote, experts, we've moved away from our position of representative government into an effective oligarchy, which is not something that would even be supported by our government on any level and is not historically accurate as far as the position of governance. So you can't take that political aspect out of the equation, and that's why I think a lot of these issues become so heated is because they want to try and make it a purist issue, and it simply practically cannot be.
At this point, I'd like to bring in Kathy Miller. She's president of the Texas Freedom Network, a watchdog group. Ms. Miller, you've just heard Cynthia Dunbar talking about the work that she does with her colleagues on the Texas State Board of Education. How significant has the influence of the Education Board and specifically the conservative members, including Ms. Dunbar, been on the content of textbooks in Texas?
Well, I would say that they have been increasingly influential over the course of the last decade, and we've seen changes to textbooks as a result of their influence. We've seen publishers self-censor textbooks even in advance of a textbook adoption because of fear of controversy over their books.
When you say self-censor, what are you talking about?
Well, in 2004, for instance, health textbooks were up for adoption, and the curriculum standards required that students understand the benefits and the negative influences and negative consequences of all forms of contraception and barrier protection. But because a decade earlier there had been a huge culture war battle over teaching sex education in the classroom, publishers came forward with books that do not mention in any way any form of responsible pregnancy prevention or STD prevention or any form of contraception. And that was a self-censorship as a result of publishers deciding they didn't want to get involved in a culture war, a pitched culture war battle. The bigger question, you know, the looming influence is still out there. The question is out there about the influence that they will have over science textbooks and how biology is taught in our classrooms and now social studies. And we've just seen education become a partisan pitched culture war battle, and arguments around, you know, what political ideology ought to be taught as opposed to what students need to be successful to compete in the 21st century. I would really take issue with what Ms. Dunbar said about their listening to experts. I think that the process that is in place works to a point and then falls apart. Classroom teachers and curriculum experts are involved in writing and reviewing the curriculum standards, and then experts from our colleges and universities are supposed to come in to also ensure that, you know, the scholarly consensus is represented and kids are getting what they need to be ready for college. The problem then comes when the board refuses to consult with those experts when the amendments begin being offered. And in our most recent meeting, one of the members of the far-right faction brought a stack that was 4 inches thick of amendments to Just American History, and it was, you know, dozens and dozens of amendments, and board members saying, well, now who's that, and why do we need that? And they refused to allow board members to consult with experts, professors from our colleges and universities who will be getting our students when they graduate.
Can I ask you, Ms. Miller, is this discussion always carried out in public where members of the public can take part, and is there time to review these amendments so people know what's sort of up for discussion?
The process is very public up until the point that the amendments are introduced, and obviously we can watch the process. It is open to the public in that sense. But in terms of what the public or experts can, what impact they can have during the votes on these amendments and the final vote, it becomes very narrow. And in fact, we saw in the English language arts and reading curriculum adoption a wholesale rewriting of the curriculum standards the night before the final vote was to be taken. Some board members themselves said, hold on, I can't vote on this. I haven't even read it, let alone consulted with any experts in the field. And the far-right faction on the board forced that vote on that day, and those curriculum standards went into place.
Your standpoint is that this is not just a issue of concern for people, parents in Texas, that this has national ramifications as well. Why is that?
Absolutely. Currently, Texas is the second largest consumer of textbooks in the nation. And we're a single state, single adoption state, which means the books are adopted on a statewide level, not district by district. And even though the textbook industry is changing and modifications to textbooks have become easier because of online content, we still have publishers who are going to produce these big, expensive books to meet Texas standards. And then often those books are peddled and sold in states across the country. In a recent article in the New York Times Magazine, it was suggested that up to 46 or 47 states are buying Texas's textbooks. California buys more books than Texas, but in the face of their economic woes right now, I think for the next several years to come, Texas may be the largest consumer of textbooks. So that influence is huge across the nation.
Cynthia Dunbar, a member of the Texas State Board of Education, we all know science curriculums have been a sensitive subject for many years due to the debate over evolution versus creationism. This year, your panel has been reviewing history texts. What kind of debate has come up over that issue?
Well, we had probably the largest response and debate that initially came forward, which is a little bit unique, not so much from problems that the board members had, but some of the work groups had come forward with making some suggestions, such as taking Christmas out and taking out at one point a reference to Nathan Hale. And so there were some suggestions that I think showed kind of a bias or tendency to move away from a certain viewpoint. However, the board as a whole, I have not seen, as we've been addressing these social studies TEKS, the same types of concerns. Of course, they're always there. And that's, I guess, my position is that these tensions as to, well, even as what Ms. Miller stated, as to the experts, I mean, the real question then becomes if we're going to take it away from an elected body who is accountable to the people and establish it in the framework of who may be deemed the experts, then the question is always going to be who's experts, and then there is no voice for the electorate to be able to determine what they want. We had a large influx of response from people coming forward saying that they didn't want to see Christmas taken out, that they wanted to have a patriotic viewpoint presented, which Texas, we actually have a statutory obligation to promote patriotism and to promote the free enterprise system. So that has been a theme that we've tried to preserve throughout the adoption process.
Kathy Miller with the Texas Freedom Network. You've just heard what Cynthia Dunbar said, that basically that, you know, by having the Board of Education make these decisions, they're elected officials, they can be held accountable by the voters. What do you say to that, that academics, you know, they're not elected, that voters can't weigh in on the decisions they make?
Well, I think that there's a way to get around the issue that Ms. Dunbar brings up. The legislature has a great deal of authority over the powers of the State Board of Education with respect to curriculum and textbook adoption, so with respect to the content decisions they make. And they can very easily put in place a mechanism that formalizes the process or formalizes the role for classroom teachers and for professors from Texas colleges and universities who will be teaching the vast majority of the kids when they graduate from Texas public high schools. And to put in place a structure that doesn't eliminate an elected board, but requires a supermajority maybe of that board to override an expert opinion, their authority would not be taken away in that sense, and there would still be accountability to the people both through the election of state board members and through the election of members of the legislature, so it would be kind of dually accountable. But for instance, the state board was faced with They had a MacArthur Fellow from microbiology who's a member of the National Academy of Science, one of the world's most respected science bodies, standing before them saying, "I will be here to answer any questions you may have about amendments offered on biology." And Ms. Dunbar and others on the board said, no, we don't need that. We're fine. And then proceeded to offer amendments that Nobel laureates disagreed were actually science, and forcing things into the textbooks that make Texas students learn non-science. That's just, I mean...
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought for a moment. We'll continue this conversation after a brief break. Later on Reporter's Notebook, the government rights an age-old wrong for black farmers. We'll be back in just a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We've been talking about who should have input on the content of classroom textbooks, specifically in the state of Texas, where the State Board of Education has a 7-member block of Christian conservatives who at times have been accused of allowing their personal and religious beliefs to influence the content of classroom teaching. I'd like to bring in again Cynthia Dunbar, who is a member of the Texas State Board of Education. Ms. Dunbar, I understand that this year the big issue that you are discussing as far as textbooks are concerned is history. And I understand specifically one of the big questions has been how much to talk about the role that religion may have had in the founding of the United States and whether the United States is a Christian country. Is that correct?
Obviously, that's going to be one of the issues that may be more contentious. But I think that one of the things that we've seen coming forward, and this is Very interesting, and you know, when we're talking about history, Teeks, we know that we're a government that's governed by the consent of the people, and I think that's why it's very important to support a representative body when we're dealing with the education of our children, for the parents to have a voice. And they do that in and through their elected officials. But beyond that, yes, I think that it's good for our students to learn who we are as Americans. One of the things, and being a lawyer by trade, and I'm thinking at this in the context of perhaps hearsay within a courtroom, that there are exceptions to be able to present it. And hearsay would be testimony where you don't have the individual person there to testify. Well, clearly, pertaining to history, Teeks, we don't have
the
founding fathers.
We should point out that Teeks are the guidelines for instruction in Texas schools. Is that correct?
It's technically the mnemonic for the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. And so when we're adopting those, obviously we don't have the founding fathers present to be able to testify as to their viewpoints. But with hearsay, it's admissible. There's an exception when it's not for the truth of the matter asserted, but simply that that's what they said. And I think that it does our students a disservice to not bring forth some of our charter documents to let the students know what the founding fathers were saying. It doesn't get to the level of rising to do you agree with them or do you adopt these beliefs, but simply this is what they were stating at the time. And I think to be a well-educated populace, we need to have our students at least be able to study these documents to have a full understanding of our American history.
My understanding is that you've written that the founding fathers created, quote, an emphatically Christian government. What do you mean by that?
Well, simply, I mean, if you do any extensive studying, it doesn't take very long to see that it was, in fact, emphatically Christian. I mean, if you look even at some of the quotes of, you know, like John Jay, for example, who was our first Chief Justice. I mean, his statement was that providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it's the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. This was their viewpoint, and it's not an ecclesiastical sense of adopting a religious ideology like perhaps it would be with Sharia law, but it is the adoption of civil jurisdiction from a biblical worldview. And that was the framework that our founding fathers were operating from. It's clear when you look at the people that the founders were quoting and understanding the laws of nature and of nature's God, which is in the very beginning of the preamble of our declaration. You can't review American history in a vacuum or in the absence of understanding that Christian worldview.
I'd like to bring in Randall Balmer. He's a professor of American religious history at Columbia's Barnard College. Professor Balmer, is the United States a Christian nation?
It is in one sense and one sense only, in that the majority of Americans claim to be Christians. Yes, in that sense, it is a Christian nation. But in terms of the founders, I'm sorry, this is a fiction that has been perpetrated by the religious right for some time now. And I'd have to ask Ms. Dunbar to account for example, the Treaty of Tripoli, which was read before the U.S. Senate in 1797, actually June 7th, 1797, and was approved unanimously by the U.S. Senate. Article 11 reads, "The United States is of America is not in any sense a Christian nation." What do you do with that? What do you do with Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, which very clearly calls for a separation of church and state?
Ms. Dunbar, isn't this a violation of separation of church and state?
Well, absolutely. How do I answer that? That's really the wrong question. Because separation of church and state as it's understood today from a constitutional perspective is totally a distinct, different viewpoint than how the founding fathers viewed it. Was there an understanding of separation? Yes, but it was a jurisdictional understanding. And if you read Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance, you can clearly see what the viewpoint was. It was one of what is the framework of civil jurisdiction appropriately defined from a biblical worldview. The Treaty of Tripoli is easy to explain. because basically it is defining language. When they go through and talk about as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslimin. So it was a defining language in the sense that we're not a Christian language in the sense of establishing ecclesiastical rule or that we have any enmity against people being able to worship God according to the dictates of your conscience. But the problem is you can't even understand those concepts in the absence of an understanding of a biblical worldview. And that's really what we're dealing with, is that it's kind of like people who don't speak a foreign language trying to interpret a document with a limited understanding. You can't speak that language if you don't understand it from the context of a biblical worldview, which is what the founding fathers really had. And that doesn't mean that they were all devoutly Christian in their faith, but it does mean that they operated from this framework of what appropriate civil jurisdiction looked like. And mm-hmm. that's why we have the laws of nature and of nature's God. And so there's no problem with it in the context of separation of church and state, other than the fact that, you get into the whole issue of education and tax-supported education and how the framers would have looked at that, because the way they defined religion.
Okay, I'd like to step in here and follow up with someone else on a couple of the points you made. Susan Jacoby is with the Center for Inquiry, a rationalist think tank, and author of the book Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. Ms. Jacoby, is the United States a Christian country, and have we maybe expanded the idea of what the founders originally meant by separation of church and state?
Well, it's very interesting. I really would congratulate Ms. Dunbar on obfuscating what the real arguments in Texas are about. Nobody would ever say, no good scholar would ever say, that the role of religion, as the role of secularism in American history, should not be explored in classes. What Ms. Dunbar and her fellow conservative Christian right members of the Texas Board are doing is they want their particular version, their ideas about the relationship of Christianity to this nation, to be explored. Now, the laws of nature and nature's God in the Declaration of Independence was, in fact, a deist. It was very different from saying Jesus Christ has established our right to create this country. And I notice in her talk about religion and what role it should play, Ms. Dunbar doesn't mention a very important fact, which is barely taught in any American high school, that the founders deliberately left any reference to God out of the Constitution. There was a huge fight about this. It was thoroughly discussed at all of the state ratifying conventions. And they didn't leave it out. As I said, I was interviewed for that New York Times article. They didn't leave it out because they were atheists or even deists. The founders ranged from Orthodox Christians to people who didn't much believe in God at all. But what united them was is they knew that too close a relationship between religion and government is trouble. And why wouldn't they have known that? It was trouble in every other country in the world. And so that when we're talking about including the history of religion in the curriculum, that's fine, as long as it also includes what's been true since the founding of this nation, that there has always been a tension between religion and secularism, and it was a very creative tension in the founding of the Republic. But the way that the right wing wants to twist history was perfectly embodied in Ms. Dunbar's reference to Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance. What Madison was doing was fighting a proposal by Patrick Henry in Virginia, which would have taxed all citizens of Virginia for the support of Christian teaching in schools. In other words, his memorial and remonstrance was an article against that. I'll bet Ms. Dunbar doesn't want that fact in her version of the history curriculum.
In an era when the country's population is growing more and more religiously diverse, then how do you bring into the classroom, how do you discuss the role that religion might have played in the founding of the country?
Well, I hate to say this, but one of the things you do is that there are all kinds of experts, like Professor Balmer, for example, who would hardly want to diminish the role of religion in this country. The role of religion in this country is important, but it needs to be taught as it was, not in the fantasies that the Christian right today would have. For example, it's taught in every school. It was taught when I went to school that the first settlers came here for religious freedom. Well, that wasn't true in Virginia. In Virginia, the first settlers came for commercial reasons, but in Massachusetts, it was. And one of the first things that happened was that the Puritans, who were fleeing religious persecution in England, set up a theocracy in Massachusetts and soon started to persecute other Christians who didn't believe as they do. And one interesting thing, one of the right-wing proposals in Texas was to take Anne Hutchinson, who's been in school curriculums probably since there were textbooks, who was driven out of Massachusetts, both for disagreeing with the Puritan theocracy there, but the religious right doesn't like any use of the word theocracy, to Rhode Island, and also because she was a woman who dared to talk whereas only male ministers were supposed to talk. But in other words, if you're going to talk about religion and the importance of the desire for religious freedom in the founding of this country, you also need to talk about how the many conflicts there were. And also, one of the reasons that the federal Constitution doesn't mention God, which, and this should be taught in every textbook, was, is that every state constitution at the time the federal Constitution was ratified had requirements that people who weren't Christians or weren't Protestants, or in the case of Massachusetts, of New York, Catholics couldn't run for public office. The Constitution in Article 6 says there shall be no religious test for federal office. And this was, in fact, it's quite the contrary of what the religious right is trying to put into textbooks. This is the Founding Fathers saying to the states, you're wrong. Everybody who's an American citizen, whatever their religion, should be able to run for public office, or whether they have any religion at all.
Randall Balmer, professor of American religious history at Columbia's Barnard College. You've just heard Susan Jacoby with the Center for Inquiry saying that, yes, it is appropriate to discuss in the classroom the role that religion played in the founding of this country. Do you think public schools do a good enough job of that, or do you think they tend to shy away from it a little bit?
They don't do a good job of it at all. They do shy away from it, and I think it comes out of misguided understandings or a lack of understanding about the First Amendment and the separation of church and state. I've been advocating for years, as Susan knows and others, I'm sure, for the inclusion of references to religion and the importance of religion in shaping American life and culture. There's no question about that. I don't think you can come away with a solid understanding of American history, or really with any understanding of American history, without understanding the role that religion has played in shaping our history, our society, and our culture. But that's a very, very different thing from making claims that America was and always has been a Christian nation. That's simply not the case. It's a seductive idea, and especially in our current political climate, there's a particular faction of society that wants to rewrite history to that effect. But it is it's a lie. It's a very dangerous lie, in my judgment. And let's remember why it's so important to maintain this distinction. The whole idea, the whole metaphor for the separation of church and state comes from Roger Williams, who is the founder of the Baptist tradition in America. And he worried that the garden of the church would be sullied by the wilderness of the world were it not for a wall of separation. That's the metaphor that Jefferson picks up in his letter to the Danbury Baptists in 1802. And the important thing to remember here is that Roger Williams recognized the dangers to the integrity of the faith when it is too closely associated with the state, because it becomes fetishized. I'll give you a quick example of that. I was one of the expert witnesses in the Alabama Ten Commandments case when Judge Roy Moore, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, plopped this 2.5-ton granite monument in the lobby of the judicial building, emblazoned with the Ten Commandments. And when the judge ruled correctly, that is, Judge Thompson, that this represented a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and ordered its removal, one of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God." Now, unless I'm mistaken, one of those commandments on the side of that monument said something about a graven image. And that vindicates precisely what Roger Williams feared when there's too close association between the church and the state.
Cynthia Dunbar, with the Texas State Board of Education, is this too close an association of church and state? Very quickly, is this allowing personal religious beliefs to influence the content of textbooks, and is that really appropriate?
Well, I'm probably going to shock you with my answer, but absolutely it is. And that is part of what I've seen by serving on the board during this time, that what the push was through Abington v. Shemp was with the court case where the court ruled that secularism could not be taught in the sense of affirmatively opposing or showing hostility to religion and preferring those who didn't believe to those who did. And what you find out is that in dealing with education and adopting these types of things, it's going to be one person's viewpoint and belief that's going to trump another.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about in the classroom with our students and our children and what they're being taught. And is that an appropriate function of civil government? And I absolutely would say that the whole Memorial and Remonstrance should be taught,
mm-hmm.
because Madison's viewpoint was that religion is wholly exempt from civil society's cognizance. And how he defined religion was the duties which we owe to our Creator.
Right.
I'd
like to actually follow up on one of the points you just made with Kathy Miller with the Texas Freedom Network. Ms. Miller, basically the idea that this is the job of elected officials, somebody has to make this decision. What has the public response been to the work of the Texas Board of Education?
Well, it's been amazing how much media coverage there's been to what the board has proposed across the social studies spectrum, from proposed changes to the way we teach about civil rights and civil rights struggles in our state and nation through the inclusion of religion. The thing that became incredibly clear during the course of the conversation we just had here on this program is that there's a political perspective, and then there is a consensus scholarly view about what is true in American history or biology or any of the other subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And what I agree that these elected officials are making these decisions, but for them to choose to willfully silence expert opinion and ignore it in favor of political perspective is where the process breaks down. And that is what we've seen time and again, promoting a narrowly construed biblical worldview that promotes one particular religious faith over all others in a public school classroom, to promote a particular political agenda,
mm-hmm.
over consensus scholarly opinions and scholarly studies, is absolutely doing a disservice to the students in Texas and around the nation who will be reading the textbooks that come out as a part of this process.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you to all of our guests, Kathy Miller with the Texas Freedom Network, Cynthia Dunbar with the Texas State Board of Education, Randall Ballmer, Professor of American Religious History at Barnard College, and Susan Jacoby, author of Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. The Obama administration yesterday announced a $1.25 billion deal with black farmers. Could this make amends for decades of alleged discrimination against black farmers in America? We'll find out more in a moment on To The Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. The Obama administration announced a $1.25 billion settlement yesterday over racial bias in the USDA's loan program. If approved by Congress, this would be the second round of damages in a class action lawsuit brought against the government by African American farmers. Here to provide some background is Herbert White, editor of the Charlotte Post, a weekly newspaper serving the black community in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. White, I think a little history might be helpful here. In a nutshell, when was this suit brought and why?
The lawsuit was brought in 1997 by Timothy Pigford, a farmer from Washington, North Carolina, in the eastern part of the state. And his argument then, as a class action lawsuit took shape, was that thousands of black farmers through the years had been systematically locked out of loans by the federal government through the Department of Agriculture. And as a result of that, African-American farmers were not able to buy equipment, grain, livestock, what have you, through loans that traditionally small family-owned farms could access over the years. And the toll that that came of this was that a lot of times crops couldn't be planted. Machinery that broke down was ultimately, you know, useless to them. And as a result of that, they could no longer ply their trade. And from that, a lot of these farmers fell behind on their mortgages, were unable to keep up with payments on machinery, crops, or what have you, and ultimately went out of business. They had to give up their property either through foreclosure or selling it off. And that type of damage helped exacerbate the demise of black farming in this country.
Was this just blatant discrimination that they said, you know, no, I'm sorry, you're African American, this isn't happening? Was it sort of more subtle than that? How did it work?
A lot of it was stalling, basically.
So sort of, you know, fill out more paperwork, give us more information. We need to get back to you.
Yeah, and we'll get back to you when we're finished with everybody else. Just wait your turn, that type of thing. And so by the time a lot of these folks were helped, if they were helped at all, prime growing season came and went, and it was too late to put new crops into the ground or even work on buying new machinery, because if you don't have that money in hand, you can't make those acquisitions. And so as a result of that foot dragging from the government side, that these folks just didn't have the time necessary to keep their farms up to date and basically stay afloat.
How far back does this trend go? Are we talking decades? And how many African-American farmers might have been affected?
Well, the true number may never be known, but it would be safe to say that we're talking about 50, 60 years where farmers have talked about how difficult it was to get money from the federal government and through local loan agencies that work with USDA. So if you're talking about back into the 50s and 60s, and keep in mind, America was still heavily dependent on farming in terms of providing jobs back in those days through family farms. And it, again, had the effect of forcing out more people from the family farm than if they were able to get that access to capital the way that other farmers were able to access it.
This settlement comes at a time when agribusiness has become very dominant in farming. Is the settlement going to make a difference at this point for African-American farmers? How many are left?
It won't make much of a difference, I don't think. If you're talking about the number of farmers left in America who happen to be black, you're talking less than 18,000 of them. And that's not an awful lot of family farms. And when you think about not only the number of farms that have been cut away, but you're also talking about the amount of acreage that these folks control. And it just basically creates a devastating vice where you're talking about, on the one hand, the money that would come from this settlement is not going to be enough to help these folks go out and restart farms. And the other side of that is, even if they did, you know, family farms are under siege anyway from the big business of farming from corporate America. And so it's, you know, it's almost like a consolation prize. You know, we appreciate the struggles that you've gone through, and here's a little something to help ease the pain. But, you know, when all is said and done, if you are out of farming now, $50,000, which is sort of, I guess, the one of the ceiling points of this particular settlement, you know, $50,000 or so, that's not going to make much of a dent, not in today's America, not with the price of equipment and land being what it is.
Very quickly, though, do you think that this could be sort of a warning or an indication for other government programs that, you know, make sure that this is not a policy that you're practicing?
Well, it's a cautionary tale, but you have to wonder, you know, how well that tale will be received. You know, when you're talking about a government that has its own history of systemic discrimination, mm-hmm. you have to wonder, you know, where else in government, whether it's in hiring or loans or what have you, do these things still exist here in 21st century America?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's by no means eradicated, I don't think, but it's a good cautionary tale, and maybe this will help mm-hmm. in some other way going forward.
Herbert White, editor of the Charlotte Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The producers of To the Point are Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderton, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott. The technical director is Mike Newport. The managing producer is Karen Radsner. I'm Cherry Glazer, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.